Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Before we begin today's recording, I wanted to let you know that my conversation with today's guest begins with her own personal struggle of alcohol abuse and an attempted suicide. I know this can be a very triggering topic for some, so if you would like to jump ahead to still receive the important information that our guest has to offer today, please look into the show notes below for the exact time where you can rejoin our conversation without a somewhat graphic detail of what was going on in our guest's life as she was reaching her breaking point. Please enjoy today's episode. Hey everyone, today's episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox partners with people who are dedicated to doing the right thing, never cutting corners and always looking for ways to improve. Discover why they're the trusted source of high quality protein for families across the country. At ButcherBox, they believe in better. For them, that means caring about their animals and the planet, treating our planet with respect. It means improving the lives of animals and the livelihoods of farmers, and ultimately it means better meals enjoyed together. The protein from ButcherBox is never given antibiotics or added hormones. It's humanely raised. Our family loves the convenience and quality, and knowing that we are getting humanely raised and sustainably harvested protein. You can customize your box with the right amount of food and variety of meat to fit your family's individual needs. If you're interested in getting a special offer, go ahead and head to healinggroundmovement.com/resources to follow the link for ButcherBox. Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Healing Ground Movement. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and with me today, we have Nancy McKay. Now, I'm really excited to bring up this topic that Nancy is here to chat with us about because it's something that we have touched tangentially in a lot of our other interviews, and that's the issue around addiction and alcoholism, as well as the habits and the stigma that comes with it. Now, Nancy is a life and equus coach who helps women stop over-drinking. She is the founder of Amazing Outlook Coaching and works with women virtually and with the help of horses to uncover the limiting beliefs and behaviors that are keeping them stuck in the effing muck. Nancy quit drinking in 2009. Now, this is a big topic. I know that particularly as we edge out of pandemic years, we have a lot of habits that some of us may have picked up along the way, not necessarily drinking for many, but for some, we see addiction and coping habits on the rise. So I think this is a really timely conversation. And Nancy, I just can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Well, could you dive in and share a little bit of your story and your journey to sobriety to give the listeners a little more information about you?
Sure. Well, I started drinking when I was in high school with all my friends. And, you know, that just made me feel much more comfortable in my own skin and allowed me to really interact with people socially much more comfortably. So that was lovely. took off that discomfort edge, right? When you're in high school. And then in my 20s, did a little bit of partying. I had gotten married early, didn't do any drinking really of any sort while I was married for 2 years. And then after I got divorced at the age of 21, I started partying with my friends a little bit more and so on and so forth. My 30s, things ramped up a bit. And by the time I was 40, I was hitting it pretty hard. You know, I was really, well, I was probably a daily drinker at that point with heavier drinking on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Still, you know, very, very functional, still holding down a job, still, you know, doing all the things. And, but, you know, we were, my husband and I, we weren't married at the time, but we were the fun couple. We were, you know, the party started when we got there. So life was good. And yet there were elements of red flags that I knew that I was drinking too much. And when I did, things kind of didn't completely go off the rails, but, you know, went south a little bit. And so it would make me question things. And if I drank enough, then it would make me feel really rotten. And so I'd lay off for a couple weeks, and never with the intention that I was quitting, but just that I was, you know, I felt so rotten that drinking was the last thing on my mind. And then, you know, things just kept ramping up. And there was no place for me to really go or anyone to talk to about my drinking and the concern that I was beginning to have. Without the intention of not stopping, you know, unless you're going to stop, there's no place to go, right? You know, unless that's your intention, is that I'm going to have to stop drinking, there's nobody to really talk to.
It does really speak to a lot of how we see drinking in our American culture, which is, you know, it's either you have a problem with it or you don't. And there's not much of a gray area for discussion or experience anywhere in the middle.
Right. And that's interesting that you bring up gray area, because that's an element. It's called gray area drinking now. And it's kind of in that middle zone. You know, it's people who are over drinking, but aren't necessarily addicted, but they're not, you know, they're drinking more than just socially.
Yeah.
And so that's where I was. I was in that, you know, kind of, I think you could probably call gray area drinking as abusive drinking. You know, it's beyond social, and it's not quite alcoholic, but you're abusing, you know, you're abusing it. And that's where I was. And so, you know, I'd go to the bookstore and sort of sheepishly go down the aisle of addiction and, you know, look over my shoulder and hope nobody saw me pull the books off the shelf and check out at the counter. And then I'd get home and I'd read a little bit about it, and it's really, you know, hit me in the gut. And so I put it on the shelf because I wasn't ready to deal with it emotionally. I just, you know, that was too permanent. That was too hardcore for me to think about at that time. And so, you know, life was going on, and I kept drinking, knowing that it was, you know, I knew that it was dimming me, you know, that I wasn't living up to my potential because of it. But I know I knew that, but I wasn't listening to that inner wisdom. I knew there was something there, but I wasn't enlightened enough to really pay attention to it. I thought that, you know, I just thought it was something else. And so I didn't pay attention to it.
It's a really poignant and I think powerful place to share from vulnerability, because I think that that's that pivot point that so many of us come to in whatever habit it is that we're looking at, whatever stage in our health, which is where that idea of this isn't right anymore is just a whisper. Yeah. Or the truth of when you said you put the books away, I've had experiences like that where it's just, this is just too true. This is so much louder than the whisper in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
You know, the volumes don't match. And trying to find that place where you're ready to meet the new information with the same conviction of being ready to let go of an old story.
Right.
You know, that's a powerful part of the journey that I think doesn't get acknowledged in the way that it deserves.
Right. Definitely. Definitely. So as I went on, my father, who was an alcoholic, and had, you know, quit and started and quit and started, did the relapse tango many times, ended up killing himself when I was 50.
I'm so sorry.
And it was really tough. And I felt a huge amount of guilt. And so I started drinking over that. And to just numb myself from these emotions that I was having, these huge emotions that I just couldn't deal with. And so it took me 2 years from the time he killed himself until the time that I tried to kill myself, that my drinking really escalated. And, you know, emotionally, the wheels were starting to fall off. Mm-hmm. And so one night after happy hour with my husband and some friends, we came home. I had finished off the little bit of wine that we'd had in the house and before we left, and we got home and I said, damn it, we should have stopped at the liquor store. We're all out of wine. And my husband said, well, I think you've had enough. And that sent me off the deep end. And I got mad and slammed the bedroom door and proceeded to have a pity party, and then got to the point in my head, and this is how powerful our thoughts can be, was that everyone would be better off without me. So I got out of bed and I walked around to my husband's nightstand and I pulled his handgun out of the drawer and I put it to my head and it wouldn't fire. And I was so confused. Why isn't this working? I almost called him into the room to help me figure out how to work the damn thing. And as I held the gun down, and when I realized that the safety was on and figured out how to take the safety off, the gun fired. And my favorite line of the story is that the only thing that got shot was an innocent pillow on the bed. And that was the last time I drank.
Wow. Wow. What an incredible, but for the grace, I mean, to have that.
Exactly. Grace that is moment. Exactly the word.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was so desperate to stop hurting. You know, and I thought that I was, you know, hurting so horribly, which was a thought that, you know, you can't survive this. You've done you feel so guilty and everyone would be better off without you. And those thoughts damn near killed me. And so that was the end of my drinking career, and I started going to AA, and they saved my life.
Well, I am so grateful for that safety feature on that gun and the pillow that took a bullet for you, that you are here to share your wisdom and experience with the world. I mean, unfortunately, so often the wisdom is hard earned. And you certainly have to start looking at the impacts of stigma of drinking and alcoholism, you know, when it exists in that gray area of abusive coping, when we can see those little red flags, you know, in hopes that no one else comes to the moment that you did, that we can turn around at an easier road, perhaps.
Right. And that's why I do what I do. Is because I want to help anyone who's in that gray area, mm-hmm. you know, who knows that there's a problem, but they're not you know, they're not ready to admit that they're an alcoholic, because maybe they're not at that point, but, you know, and the stigma of alcoholism, that kept me drunk for a long time. And so, because I wasn't ready to admit that. Right. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. So I kept drinking, you know, I didn't quit, you know, I wasn't ready to do that either, you know? And so you just keep drinking. And unless you understand that how your mind plays a part in all of that, then you don't address what you're thinking about your drinking. Right? And so if you're not addressing that, then you don't take action on it. And so you just keep going the way you've been going, because you don't know any better. You don't know how to do it differently.
Well, it's such a catch 22 that not having the resources to attend to drinking in a way that is not healthy for you means that you might as well go ahead and keep drinking until it is, you know, a dire problem, until it truly is alcoholism. And it gives no resources and no way to get off the train earlier. Right. And you spoke at the beginning about these red flags when you were kind of in that gray area, you know, the party started when you arrived area. What were those early red flags when you started looking for resources?
Well, I remember this really vividly. One Saturday afternoon, I was sitting on our patio drinking a glass of Chardonnay, smoking my Marlboro Lights, reading the Four Agreements, and wondering what my purpose was in life, right? And why I didn't feel fulfilled. And, you know, little did I know that the alcohol was creating like this veil between me and fulfillment. But I didn't know that, you know. I just, at that point, I wasn't significantly abusing alcohol, you know. On the weekends, we were kind of weekend warriors, and, you know, but, you know, it didn't feel like it was a huge problem at that point, but there was that little element that was kind of my first red flag that I, looking back, I realized that was my awareness of things aren't quite the way they should be, or they could be. And I hadn't connected the dots yet.
So could you talk to us a little bit more about how alcohol does sort of pull the veil over your eyes, pull the veil over your experience of how you engage with the world? Because kind of how you were talking about in the beginning, and I think this is a pretty ubiquitous experience with beginning to drink, is that it makes it easier. It makes it easier to go out and be social and engage with people around you. Just loosen up a little bit.
Right.
So where does that initial feeling conflict with, you know, being in tune with your purpose and your sense of self?
So I chuckle because, you know, it makes you feel more comfortable, and it made me feel prettier and more vivacious and so on and so forth. And so as time went on, it took me from there to being quite promiscuous in an effort to, you know, I was definitely looking for love in all the wrong places, sort of thing. You know, I was the epitome of drinking too much and falling in love, you know, a lot, thinking that I was, you know, that I was truly falling in love. And yet it was bad judgment is what it was. And so, you know, one of the things that most people think of is that they'll never have fun again if they stop drinking, right? That alcohol creates this fun, and it's a party and everybody's celebrating and everything's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So if something can enhance your circumstances, right? It can also dampen the circumstances just as easily. Mm. Right. And so what we think we're gaining is really clouding everything. It takes the edge off. So if it takes the edge off the bad stuff, it's also taking the edge off the good stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what people don't want to understand. They don't understand that there's an edge to the good stuff that's getting softened, numbed, mm-hmm. right? Worn down, just like it helps wear down the rough edges of the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And so they think it enhances the good and helps with the bad. And it doesn't. It does the same thing to both circumstances. We just are in a different mindset when the good stuff is going on than we are when the bad stuff is going on.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. From what I understand, alcohol in and of itself, you know, reduces our engagement with short-term consequences, you know, that it's not that it so much lets us, you know, have the good stuff, as you're saying. It's not just on the one-sided piece. It's just that short-term consequences, not that big a deal. Good, bad, indifferent, or otherwise. And so we can really see a careless flowing that comes with it, as opposed to, you know, sitting in, as we go back to this work you were doing with the four agreements, sitting in what is my purpose and where am I supposed to be? You know, that's a conversation where we engage with ourselves in our immediate choices and their immediate consequences and how those build up over time. And if you're never engaging with what is right in front of you, you're never going to arrive anywhere purposefully down the road. Right. Is sort of what I hear you saying.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so if you don't have a grasp on what your purpose is, you know, on what your passion is, because it's clouded over with, you know, because you're drinking so much or frequently, then you just, you stay stuck in that spot. And then chances are, when you're drinking an addictive substance, which alcohol is, then if you keep it up, pretty soon you're going to find yourself addicted. Mm-hmm. You know, if you keep it up at that rate, and chances are it'll escalate like things do mm-hmm. when you're drinking an addictive substance. And so now you're in a really tough spot mm-hmm. because now you need it.
Yeah.
And it takes over. And, you know, I was, you know, one of the good things with me pulling the stunt that I did was it prevented me from getting deeper into my addiction. You know, I hadn't gotten to the point where I was drinking in the morning in order to function. But that probably wouldn't have been too far down the road if I hadn't put a gun to my head. And so we, you know, people don't think through that progression mm-hmm. because this is a progressive disease. It doesn't get better on its own unless you quit. Mm-hmm. And so if you wait until you're addicted, then that kind of takes out that moderation opportunity. Mm. You know, because once you become addicted, then, you know, there's probably a few schools of thought here, but, you know, it's like, you know, if I were to start drinking again, chances are very good. And there's a theory that that the degrees that the, pardon me, the disease progresses even if you're not consuming alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I were to start drinking again, it would be as if I had kept drinking for the last 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I would re-enter the addiction phase at a much worse place than I left it 13 years ago. And personally, I'm not willing to take that chance. You know, I don't think it's worth it because my life has gotten so much better since I stopped drinking. And so why would I want to take that chance?
Oh, absolutely. Right? And that's certainly what I've seen and heard through any of my studies around addiction or coming from a family where addiction is rather prevalent, is that you do re-enter, you kind of walk through the same door you just left and keep going.
Yeah.
And then your body is constantly looking through that next level. Because we develop these abilities to acclimate and cope to whatever level of chemical stimulation we're having in our body, you know, whatever chemical form of addiction we're talking about here. And once we have gotten used to that level, we need the next one in order to have the same effects, which, as you pointed out, is why the drinking has become such a crutch in the first place. Because without being able to engage and find your way through that present moment without the help of alcohol, it becomes the only way to find yourself through a present moment. And where it was once social situations that are perhaps uncomfortable, now it becomes, you know, the very existence of your morning for some, and should have exactly. gotten that far.
Exactly. Exactly.
So when we look back to this area of this gray area of kind of abusive drinking, because as you pointed out so wonderfully in the beginning, that's where we lack resources.
Right.
You know, gratefully, we have wonderful programs. You know, when one gets to the point of admitting they have a problem with alcohol, when they admit that they're an alcoholic, and success in those programs varies depending on the commitment of the individual. Mm-hmm. But what about this area of, I think I just don't want to keep living like this anymore, but this is embarrassing to talk to my friends because they're all drinking every night and they're fine. So it appears to me,
right.
You know, this is,
that's part of the,
yeah, this is normal. Everybody has a beer or a glass of wine with dinner, right? You know, these kind of self-talk questions about what is completely normalized around alcohol. Because I'll share from the other side of it. I'm a very minimal drinker. I probably have about one or two drinks a month. So I turn down more drinks than I accept. And the very common question is, so you don't drink, that it has to be an all or nothing rather than a, nah, tonight's just not worth it. Where do we find our place in that gray area when that's the communication of the culture?
Such a great question. And so one of, you know, I feel like part of my passion really is to normalize not drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what one of the things that I find so interesting, and I saw this, I think it was on Instagram or something, someone wrote, alcohol is the only drug that we have to make excuses not to take.
It is so true.
Right.
And that is still like culturally forced upon you, because I was just thinking that even when I say no to a drink, it's sort of like, oh, it reminds me, I just watched My Big Fat Greek Wedding where he's saying, well, he's a vegetarian. She goes, okay, I just make lamb. And it's can I get you a drink? No, I have water. Okay. I'll just get you a cider, you know, and you have a drink anyway. It's like, this is still a drug.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And
so I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go on.
It's the truth. I mean, it's like, you know, no, thank you. I'm not drinking. What? Are you an alcoholic? Or, mm-hmm. you know, just a glass of wine. You know, I ran in January, a dry January program, and one of my friends was participating in it just because she had recognized that her drinking had ramped up over the holidays and she wanted to take a break. She wanted to support me. And so she made a comment to her stepmother one day that, you know, well, what, you know, can I get you a glass of wine? No, I'm taking a break this month. Oh, here, just a little, you know, just a little glass, you know, just a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. and take this bottle home. And, you know, it's like, nobody wants to take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because, you know, one of the things is that it's their thoughts about their drinking that's causing the conversation about your drinking. Right?
Going so, more there. Yeah.
So it's like, if you drink, it's going to make me feel better about drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trust me, I used to be the drink pusher too. You know, I was like, oh, come on, have another one, you know? And
well, because it does start to look really extreme if your company is still sipping their first drink or not having one at all, you being on your third, your fourth, your fifth starts to really stand out.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, it's, that's why I you know, really want to offer that there is something that you can do if you're in that spot, if you're in that gray area, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to quit, but I want you to try to take a break so you can see the difference.
Mm.
And notice what your thoughts are about the whole process, right? And so, you know, when you think you can't stop or when you don't want to stop, you know, let's look at the reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about that so that you have a better understanding of your relationship with alcohol.
And what are some of the reasons that often come up with the people that you're with whom you're working?
That why they don't want to quit or why they
mm-hmm. yeah, what the resistance is around around being in that matter. I imagine that there's probably a handful that are pretty typical.
Oh yeah,
might be useful for our listeners to hear.
Well, they're all of them are worried about what people are going to think. Right? Either they're going to make fun of me, they're going to think I'm, you know, an alcoholic and I have to stop. They're people are so wrapped up in what are people going to think of me? And that comes from our own thoughts about what we think of ourselves. So if I'm thinking that I have a drinking problem, then everybody else is going to think I have a drinking problem if I do something about it.
Right? I'm going to prove them right. Prove me right. Where's the mirror? Who's it pointing at?
And when in reality, you know, it's so interesting because we were both just talking about the pressure you get from people to drink. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, if you're at a party and there's a bunch of people and you're not drinking, chances are 99% of the people are not going to notice that you're not drinking.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a glass in your hand, they don't care what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
So put some seltzer in there or club soda or whatever that looks like a cocktail and don't worry about it. And don't worry so much about what people think.
Mm-hmm.
Because truly the only person that you need to worry about is yourself and what you think.
It is. Yourself. Yeah. It is really amazing. And I watched my family do this. I grew up in a dry house. For a lot of personal choices of the various members. But the confidence with which my parents would both just order seltzer and just have that with, you know, with a garnish, with a lime, and sometimes really leaning into it about wanting it in a fancy cocktail glass, because that was the fun part. And it just really normalized the idea of having fun and, you know, you're participating by having something to drink. And it's kind of interesting because there are a lot of social cues around having something in your hand, sharing a drink with someone, sharing food with someone. We see this a lot in our diet related conversations as well. The point is that you're there in a behavioral sharing, but the actual product that is on your plate or in your glass matters so much less than being in that place of sharing. And that is what everybody is actually really looking for.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I don't know. I just, the normalization of not drinking is just so important, I believe, because, you know, it's just really, that's what most people struggle with is, how am I going to tell people that I'm not drinking? You know, well, it's real easy. No, thank you.
we do tend to overcomplicate things, don't we?
We do. We do. Mm-hmm. And we think that what other people think is so much more important than it truly is. Mm-hmm. And then, I think the other thing is how exactly am I supposed to not drink when I've been drinking during these situations? You know, it's a birthday party, it's a wedding, it's whatever, right? It's Tuesday. How am I supposed to not drink on Tuesday, for crying out loud? And so we work on that and talk about, what is it about Tuesday that makes you want to drink? You know, what is it about a birthday party that begs you to have a cocktail, you know, or a wedding what's a wedding without champagne, for crying out loud, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it could be
a wedding. You know,
the glass of champagne could lead to all kinds of problems down the road if you drank like I did, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what we see. That's the romanticism of it.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the sparkling glass of champagne with the dew dripping down the side, and they don't see the, you know, the train wreck that's coming, mm-hmm. if they start out there. So,
or we've characterized that train wreck in romantic comedies as the person to be laughed at and pitied. And in a lot of ways, that's another really good reason to encourage other people to drink, because then it's not you. Exactly. You know, but
hopefully it won't be my train wreck that causes all the commotion, right? Mm-hmm. It'll be somebody else's train wreck.
Yeah. But I like how you pointed out that romanticism of the champagne glasses, and you know, we have normalized, almost even fetishized, so many of these images around drinking, even, you know, moms day drinking to cope to get through, I, you know, I see the look on your face, and you and I could go down a rabbit hole there about how we need to normalize that's the okay way to make it through motherhood, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, like asking for help, finding community.
Right.
You know, it's so much more marketable than the hard work of, why is this uncomfortable? Why do you need a glass of wine to get through an afternoon with your toddler? And, you know, I understand that for sure, but that's not the answer.
Right.
You know, and same thing with the wedding. I'll say, for our wedding, you know, we forewent. We didn't do the champagne toast. We got chocolate dipped strawberries. Everybody had a chocolate dipped strawberry. We toasted with those. And, you know, we still ended up married at the end of the night. So I think we still ticked all the boxes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that the culture, you know, that we're in now is basically at the mercy of the alcohol companies. So alcohol companies now are taking the place of big tobacco. So because the alcohol companies have stepped into that role that big tobacco had, you know, they are trying to convince us that we can't live without this, that your life is going to be so much better if you consume alcohol. And so the marketing towards moms is powerful. Mm-hmm. It is really powerful. I mean, you know, I haven't been in a liquor store for, you know, a long time. And so I don't see the exact amount of the wine that's marketed towards the moms, mm-hmm. but I do go into gift shops, and you know, there you'll see the travel coffee mug that mm-hmm. says, you know, this is my mommy wine, or, you know, this is really an adult beverage, or the onesie that says, you know, you drink too, if you, yeah. you know.
I say it is so hard to buy a gift for a new mother that doesn't have anything to do with wine culture anymore.
Yes.
You really yeah. have to look.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. And so that normalizes not only drinking, but heavy drinking that you need to drink when you're a mom, you know, mm-hmm. because how the hell else are you going to survive? Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, it has permeated our culture, and it just, you know, I'm getting on my soapbox here, but it, you know, it's just got to stop. It's
so
it's not serving us at all.
It's really not. And I think there are so many places, and you are welcome to soapbox here. I mean, that is why I created this podcast, so that I could soapbox on a weekly basis. It's been 3 years and I'm not done yet. But you know, that there are so many places where we see this easy out coping mechanism, where we see this place where we want the quick fix to get to our health, to get to our community, to get to feeling understood, to get to feeling comfortable in our own skin. Yeah. And it's so easy to market yeah. consumer goods to get there.
Yep.
And books like The Four Agreements and books like the ones that you shoved back on your shelf when you weren't ready for them, books like what I've got in this case over here, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't just do good to have them on your shelf. You have to read them and apply the deep work and question your behaviors and question your resistance yeah. to move through to the other side, which is what you're talking about here today.
Right.
There's not an easy button.
No.
And I can really appreciate, especially after the last 2 years, that easy button sounds really great. But the more we normalize it, the more we make it, that's the irony, again, the catch 22 of it, the more we make it the only way, our only get out of jail free card, the harder our life actually becomes.
Oh, yeah.
The deeper we dig our way into that rut and the further we get from the inner work of healing, that's going to get us what we've been asking for in the beginning.
Right.
And marketing knows that, and it preys on that.
Right.
Now baby's wearing a onesie about why my mommy drinks.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I could just see one happening. You know, we both have the same nap time. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, let's like clarify nap time. You know, it's just the different way to go. So, you know, we think about the stigma of drinking. We've talked about how it's been normalized for every aspect of our life, really. I mean, teenage drinking has been normalized for ages in a way that you shouldn't do it, but everyone does. Kids will be kids.
Right.
Now, you know, sports drinking, dad time, the beer gut, the dad bod, moms are drinking. I know. Where does it stop? And that brings us to the more pertinent question is, where do I stop? You know, where do you stop? Where do we find that space to acknowledge the early red flags where we're choosing alcohol, or perhaps there's something else in your cabinet? Perhaps there's marijuana. Perhaps there is an amber bottle. Perhaps there is something else. But where do we find these red flags that we are numbing and coping, and find a way out before it turns into a full-blown diagnosis of dependency and addiction? Where would you have us turn?
Well, I think we need to turn to ourselves, in that if we just listen, and if we take a moment to, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a big, long meditation or anything like that. It could, and you might, you know, you might have a drink in your hand when this occurs to you, but it's that little voice, that little bit of intuition that we all have. Mm-hmm. The question is, are we going to listen to it? Mm. Right? So it's that little voice that says, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. You know, something needs to change. You know, something like that. And if we learn to listen to that, then we know that that's the first step. That's the first thing, that knowing that something needs to change. And then you can figure out how you want to go about it. Mm-hmm. But acknowledging that there's an issue that mm-hmm. needs your attention.
Yeah.
No matter what it is.
That awareness is so key.
Yeah. And, you know, I was trained by Martha Beck and her team, which they're brilliant. And Martha always said that, I'm not going to teach you anything that you don't already know about yourself. You know everything that you need to know. It's just a matter of peeling back the layers to get to it. Mm. And so that's what I do with my clients, is I just help them peel back the layers. Once they're aware that there's an issue and they want to change it, then that's where I come in. You know, and it's just that, and it's a really quiet little voice. And it's a voice that I ignored for years and years and years. And as a result, I put a gun to my head. Mm-hmm. So if I hadn't ignored it, and if there had been someone like me around, you know, 10 years before I put a gun to my head, then I wouldn't probably have had to put a gun to my head.
Yeah.
Because I would have learned more about myself and why I was doing what I was doing and how I could change that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But so we all have that inner knowing. We all have that intuition. It's whether or not we want to pay attention to it. And that's the kicker. And so some people don't want to listen to that voice because they don't like the voice saying, you know, we got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to hear it from anyone else, and they certainly don't want to hear it from themselves. But if we're smart, we listen to that. And that's where meditation comes in, and journaling, and doing all those things, because it helps you uncover your truth.
It starts with you knowing. Oh, I love that what you shared from Martha Beck. That's a tough truth. That's a tough load of bricks. You're not going to learn anything you don't already know about yourself. But in a way, it's also really powerful. It's kind of Dorothy's shoes, the ruby slippers that you had the power all along.
Yeah.
You know, listen to the whisper of the ruby red shoes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Oh, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing such an incredible story of, you know, what really turned into victory and hope and triumph over some of these dark demons that are all too prevalent in each of our homes and houses around the country. Where can our listeners learn more from you, reach out to you if they feel so inclined?
Well, I would love to hear from anybody. You can go to my website, which is amazingoutlookcoaching.com. And I also have a group on Facebook, a private group that you can request to join, called Women and Alcohol. And so it's a, you know, still a reasonably small group, and with a lot of different varieties of sobriety, you know, from maybe I'm still drinking a little bit to, you know, I know I've got at least one woman with 29 years plus of sobriety. So, you know, everywhere in between, from not yet to you know, can't even see it in the rearview mirror anymore.
And congratulations to all of them along their journey.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you had a resource that you were generous enough to share with our listeners.
Yes. It is Are You Over Drinking? It's a little ebook, 6 questions to ask yourself to assess your relationship with alcohol. And I think you're going to put in the show notes the link that they can get that at. And, you know, it's a small, helpful tool to take a look at and see if any of those things are getting in the way, then maybe it's a good time to take a look at it.
That sounds like a really potent and powerful place to start. Thank you so much for sharing that with our listeners.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And just as Nancy said, that will be in the show notes. So you can go ahead and click that resource and work your way through those questions and begin that introspective journey as to where you need to be in your own personal way. There is no right or wrong way to exist within this world. But I think Nancy and I both do hope that you find that place where you're coming from your own truth and knowing and sense of personal responsibility in your world instead of handing that off to anyone else. So Nancy, thank you again for joining us. I so appreciate you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in today. I hope you took a little bit from this conversation, as always. I think these kind of conversations can sit really heavy. These are not easy topics. When we take a look at changing our behavior in the face of cultural norms, it becomes an act of rebellion. And that is easier for some than for others. And finding that own spark within yourself is the right place to begin. So click on that link if it suits you. And otherwise, we will see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. Be well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.